Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on Ring of Fire, the father of modern linguistics, Noam Chomsky, will be here to tell us about his new book, Because We Say So. Attorney Michael Oppenheimer will be here to talk about a strange 2014 shooting death by police in the city of Chicago. Former right-wing evangelical leader Frank Schaefer will be here to tell us why Donald Trump has managed to capture the support of evangelicals and how the establishment has been left scratching their heads. Remember, you can go to ringoffireradio.com to keep up daily with the stories progressives need to know. And you can watch Ring of Fire TV Monday through Friday at 8:30 p.m. Eastern on Free Speech TV and on our live stream at youtube.com/goleftTV. And if you want all of our audio content delivered commercial-free, subscribe to our podcast. This is the best way to support Ring of Fire. You get our three-hour radio show commercial-free plus bonus content delivered right to your computer or device. Just go to ROFpodcast.com. That's ROFpodcast.com. So, Pap, obviously a lot to talk about this week. We're going to get to, by all accounts, it's probably the coronation of Donald Trump in the Republican primary. But first, one thing that you and I have been talking about for years and has been a big issue for progressives has been President Obama's promise on the campaign trail to close Guantanamo Bay, the Guantanamo Bay prison, I guess, or gulag, if you want to call it. And I just want to know your thoughts on the plan that was, or if you can call it a plan, that was rolled out this week by the president and the Pentagon.
Yeah, look, this move by Obama, Sam, is something that he promised to handle from day one. It took nearly 7 years for him to really tackle the issue of closing Guantanamo, even though he could have done it unilaterally at any point. It would have been huge political heat, but the answer is he could have done this. But we're seeing a different Obama in his last year in office. He's not holding back anything, and he's being the president really that we wanted to see in the White House 7 years ago. This is finally the guy that was running, and then before his body was snatched by somebody else, some conservative Republican, he's finally standing up for progressive values. This could be for two reasons. First, is to help restore trust in the Democratic establishment from the progressive base of the party. They're losing, the established Democratic Party is losing their progressive base for a lot of reasons. And it's a move that could help ease progressive fears about Hillary Clinton. There's the other side of it. It can kill Hillary Clinton in this election. Obama seems to understand now that a lot of these issues plaguing Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail are because of his lack of action on issues like Wall Street, the environment, health care, and of course Gitmo. So I think this is an interesting development. If he had taken care of these issues earlier, Hillary and the entire Democratic establishment wouldn't be facing such a backlash from the progressive base of the party.
You know, and I think you can also see Hillary Clinton coming out this week. And she's always been in favor of the public option, but she clearly, her campaign made a choice to reemphasize that this week. And I think you're absolutely right. I think this is a recognition by both the Obama administration in the case of Guantanamo and in the case of Hillary Clinton's campaign that the deficiencies of the past seven years, as it were, are continuing to haunt her on the campaign trail. I mean, it's a very interesting time for her to come out with this sort of double down, I guess, if you will, on the public option. I think you're right. Hopefully we'll see even more of this. I mean, there's an opportunity for the president this week. As you know, the Republicans in the Senate said they won't even hold hearings.
Right.
For a nominee for the Supreme Court. And Mitch McConnell even implied that maybe the next president doesn't get one either. I mean, it's...
To me, this Gitmo story is about, it's about really the bigger picture of what's happened to progressives, okay? When I say that had Obama been the president that he said he was going to be, Hillary wouldn't be facing this issue where she only has a 2-point lead against Donald Trump. That's, you know, when you average everything, it's about a 2-point lead. But the second reason that Obama understands what's at stake here, he knows that torture for all the Republican candidates, you know, for Republican candidates favor this idea that, no, we don't want to do anything about Gitmo. And in the same breath, they want to say, we're not in any way responsible for ISIS or Al-Qaeda. He knows that that's on the table, and maybe that becomes a point of discussion. But, you know, you do have to scratch your head and say, why now, Mr. President? You know, why now, 7 years later, is this, why are you making this decision now? It has more downside than it does positives at this point, I think, for the Democrats. And it's a real puzzle to me.
You know, I'm going to push back on that a little bit. I mean, it might, in the context of the general election, if that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, I am.
But I don't, you know, look, if I think this at least from their perspective plays towards Hillary Clinton's strength, right? I mean, to the extent that we hear her articulate any agenda outside of her qualifications to be president, and I think this is one of the failures of her campaign, is to articulate a broader cohesive agenda, at least domestically. I think she's made the case, or you know, has made it as well as one might, that she is qualified to be president, but she hasn't necessarily made the case of what she's going to do as president in a broad cohesive way. I mean, she's listed things like family leave and equal pay and raising the minimum wage, although not as high as Bernie Sanders. But there's been no sort of broad overarching.
She doesn't feel like she has to. She feels like she's Hillary Clinton. She feels like she has some type of right to this seat as president. I mean, I honestly really do believe this. Bill Clinton believes she has some right too. And that's why, unlike Bernie, who's fighting to get the word out there about what he's going to be. What is he going to do about TPP? What's he going to do about Wall Street? What is he going to do about these very important issues? He's not equivocal. He's right out there telling us. And so, but Hillary, I don't think, feels like she has to. I think she, you know, Salon wrote an article this week, Hillary is inevitable again. Well, I'm not so sure about that, but we'll see. We'll see.
We will indeed. All right, but let's take a break. When we come back, there's two things I want to talk about. The potential inevitability of Donald Trump, and what we've seen this week, more than any other week, is this sort of shocked to hear there's gambling, right? What was that, the in Casablanca? I'm shocked to hear that there's gambling going on here, that people are starting to wake up to who the Republican Party is, and why a guy like Donald Trump is in the lead and could very well be, and it looks like will be,
the nominee.
But I also want to talk about this case. This week, Johnson & Johnson was ordered by a Missouri state jury to pay $72 million worth of damages, some of which is to the family of a woman and some of which is to charity. Emanating from her death from ovarian cancer as a function of using talcum powder. We got to take a break. When we come back, I want to hear your take on that.
Sure.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar here with Mike Papantonio, talking about the news of the week, stories you can find on our website at ringoffireradio.com. So, Pap, this week there was a huge award ordered by a state jury in Missouri against Johnson & Johnson for the company's knowledge that the talc-based baby powder and shower-to-shower that they were selling for years had the ability to cause cancer.
Yeah, ovarian cancer. Yeah, you know, they said more than that, Sam. The attorney that handled this is a friend, and he's a great lawyer, Jerry Beasley. And the reason we're involved in this case, the reason I'm handling this case also, is because I really want, I want women to understand that, you know, why would you possibly take a risk of using this shower to shower or Johnson's baby powder when there's any risk of ovarian cancer? The studies right now, actually as early as the 1980s, the studies started showing there's a connection between the minerals that are found in this powder. Because it's mined from the ground. This talcum is mined from the ground. But there's minerals that cause inflammation in the organ systems. And anytime you have inflammation, that sometimes leads to scar-based cancers. And what's happening, Sam, is they're finding the minerals that they can trace back to the powder in the tumors that are found in these women. And so the question then becomes, you know, you had the International Journal of Gynecological Cancer come out, just, they did a study, and they said, look, a woman who uses this on a regular basis has a 30 to 60% increase of ovarian cancer. It's not a, you know, that's not a coincidence. Harvard did a study. They said, they, it was even more compelling. They said a woman doesn't even have to use it regularly. She puts herself at risk every time she uses it. Because once that talcum, once the minerals from the talcum powder are absorbed into the body, they create an inflammatory process. The Journal of National Cancer Institute talked about the use of talc in ovarian cancer in 2014. They weren't equivocal about their findings. So the interesting thing about this case is that this is information that Johnson & Johnson knew is since the 1980s. The documents in this case are abhorrent. I mean, they're awful. When you start determining what did they know, that's what this jury reacted right to. You see, this wasn't just, the question, Sam, was not only were they negligent. They obviously were negligent. The question was also, did they show reckless disregard for human life? And the jury came back and said, yeah, they did. And so, you know, sometimes if this were medicine, you know, if this were something that maybe was a life-saving medicine, you had to take it, there'd be some risk-benefit analysis. There is no right risk-benefit analysis here. There's just right absolutely no benefit.
And my understanding is that there was a sense within Johnson & Johnson that they knew that these sort of the reporting of these links was going to drive down their sales, and so they reoriented who they were going to try and sell this mm-hmm to. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is, too, is that they have been basically aware that they were going to have to pay the piper at one point and have been preparing for this litigation in some way for maybe decades.
Yeah, they have. Matter of fact, what they did is they went out and hired what I call biostitutes. Those are, you know, you find them at places like Yale and Princeton, and, you know, there are these scientists or these professor types that will say anything for the right amount of money. So what they did is they went out and they phonied up some epidemiology. The epidemiology, they tried to show, you know, that it's impossible for this to cause ovarian cancer, even though you're tracing the minerals right to the ovary. And so the problem is, when you have a company like this that has that much head start, they get to change the epidemiology because they secretly pay for the epidemiology to make it look like there's no connection. That's what they did here. That's why Jerry did such a wonderful job in this case, actually working his way through that and showing that that's a fraud, that you can go hire a biostitute, which is nothing more than a scientific whore, for the right money, and they're going to say whatever you want them to say. And that's what Johnson & Johnson did here in this case.
Okay, so Pap, just tell us, in a case like this, there are a lot of potential plaintiffs out there. So what happens next? You've had this, you have this award. I assume Johnson & Johnson tries to appeal. I mean, walk us through what
okay,
happens.
Okay, what's going to happen next is this. First of all, you're going to have lawyers that have virtually zero experience, thinking, I can go handle these cases. Well, they can't. I mean, a guy like Beasley, you know, does the same thing we do. We specialize in these cases. This is what we do. And so what ends up happening is, very often, you'll have some lawyer go grab a bunch of these cases for people that need to have good representation, and they'll end up making bad law in jurisdictions. This is what my prediction is on this case. It's going to be like the, it's going to be like the scene in Jaws where the characters in the little rowboats, I'm going to go catch the big white shark. But what ends up happening is they do so much harm to the project itself. And so what I always try to tell people is know who you're hiring on something like this, because it can go bad for a lot of women. A lot of women are suffering from ovarian cancer directly related to this talc. And so the question then becomes, you have to, simply because somebody advertises and says, I handle these cases, you need to find out who they are. Because I say that because they can upset the entire process, and a lot of people can be left out in the dark because some lawyer who had no clue on what they were doing tried to handle this case against Johnson & Johnson and blew it and made bad law that affects women all over the country. So that's the first thing I always talk about. And the second thing is that this case will continue. We're going to continue. There's going to be documents that keep showing up. The documents that Jerry Beasley put in front of the jury are really bad. I mean, they showed really reckless disregard, terrible conduct by Johnson & Johnson. And that's why the jury came back like they did. My prediction is those documents will even get worse as this case goes forward.
Wow. Just amazing. And I have to say that, the 10, I guess now, 12 years that I have known you, I hear these stories from you that you deal with on a day-to-day basis when you find these documents in these corporations, and I still have the ability to be amazed at the callousness and the sheer sense that these folks, because they're making a dollar, owe nothing to the general public or their customers. It is shocking to me. Pap, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much, Sam. Just ahead, former right-wing evangelical leader Frank Schaefer will be here to tell us why Donald Trump seems to be the evangelical's choice for president. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. Many evangelicals have decided Donald Trump is their choice as the next nominee of the Republican Party for the presidency of the United States. Here to tell us how the reality TV star and self-proclaimed mogul became the religious rights darling is former evangelical leader Frank Schaefer. So, Frank, one of the things I got to say about your piece in the Huffington Post, it's an open letter to the Republican leadership that I found exceptional, was how you walked us through the creation of, if not Donald Trump, at least the phenomena of Donald Trump. But let's start back it with you start by talking about Bob Dole and Bob Dole's running mate back in the mid-90s now. Jack Kemp. Track it for us from there.
Yeah, I mean, look, I wrote this open letter to the Republican leadership, and the first thing I tell them is, hey, guys, I was one of you. Back in the 70s and 80s, my father, Francis Schaefer, and me teamed up with Dr. C. Everett Koop, who then became Ronald Reagan's Surgeon General, and we were the people who most historians now credit with essentially kicking off the Protestant pro-life anti-abortion movement. We did it with a film series called Whatever Happened to the Human Race. Back in those days, we also were very politically connected. And I would meet frequently with Jack Kemp. We met President Reagan. We had Mike, who was Ford's son, staying with us and working with us. I'm talking about Gerald Ford's son. We were connected with the Republican establishment. So I knew those guys back then. In fact, I even stayed in Jack and Joanne's home in Washington when he was running for the vice presidency with Bob Dole. The point I'm making is, look, you could disagree with the policies of these guys. You could say trickle-down economics didn't work, whatever. But nobody would ever have looked at Jack Kemp and said one of two things. No one ever called him a racist, and no one ever said he was lunatic fringe. Look, he reached out to black people. He had played with them as a football player. He had black friends, real friends that, you know, came over for dinner, not just token friends. He went after funding for Health and Human Services and housing development for the African-American community. So what I'm trying to say is if you draw a line between then and now, and, you know, I got out of the Republican movement about 25 years ago in disgust over their gay bashing and their closing the doors on women's rights and the rest of it. But if you looked at those people and then you looked at what's happened to the Republican Party, you would assume that even Ronald Reagan would be called a liberal Democrat today by comparison, because he wasn't a xenophobe. He wasn't an isolationist. He reached out to people of other color. These folks would be disgusted, for instance, with the Republicans today who won't even talk to President Obama's nominee for a Supreme Court justice. They didn't play by those sorts of rules. They were regular politicians. They were not ideological people. So what I talk about is, look, what's happened with people like Ted Cruz, for instance, is that, you know, he's kind of like we were back then, a right-wing nutcase agitator outsider. The difference is we were knocking on politicians' doors, asking them to meet with us. He's actually in the Senate.
Right.
He's running for president. And when you get to Barack Obama and the way he's been opposed and the way he's been vilified and lied about, you have proof of their extremism. I mean, these are the guys that said he wasn't born in America, that he's a Muslim, that he's a communist, that he's not a Christian. You know, you add all these contradictory statements up, but it's come from the mainstream of the party. So now fast forward to Donald Trump. These people, like the Koch brothers and these insider establishment people, are whining, saying somehow the party's been stolen from them. Who paid for the damn Tea Party? The Koch brothers.
Right.
Who set up and in motion this kind of fifth column of traitorous, American-hating, right-wing extremists who have then coalesced to become Donald Trump's foot soldiers, the Koch brothers, the Republican establishment? They made a big mistake. They made the same mistake that so many people have made in history, thinking that you can coddle a monster, whether it's a bully in a sidewalk or an enforcer or a dictator like Mussolini and Hitler and these people, and somehow after they've done what you need them to do, which in the case of the Tea Party was to vilify Barack Obama's presidency and to squander his leadership by opposing him, and then turn around and somehow rein in your attack dogs.
Right.
Well, you can't rein in your attack dogs, and Donald Trump is the result. He's not an aberration. This is the logical conclusion of where these idiots have gone with funding right-wing extremism, thinking they could then rein it in. Well, they couldn't, and now
people,
it's out of the bag, and he's going to be the nominee.
I think people forget that Donald Trump basically made his hay as a Republican icon, as a conservative icon, by providing at least some exposure to the idea that President Obama was not born in this country. He was one of the original, if not one of the original, but one of the biggest megaphones for the idea of the birther movement. And people forget that all the major Republican candidates in 2012 went to go kiss his ring in New York City.
Right.
And of course, you know, New York's not a state where any Republican candidate thought they were going to win anyways. So they were doing this for the national Republican party's ingestion, right? This was not a
right.
local New York thing.
What they did is they allowed him to say what they couldn't say. So they had to pretend that they weren't sure about the birth thing.
That's
and then
right.
they got him as an entertainer and public figure and you know, this mogul to say stuff they didn't dare say, wink, wink, nod, nod, oh, well, it's not me saying it, it's Donald saying it. And they used him as a kind of a foil to advance with the kind of people who believe this nonsense, these ideas. And essentially what we've got in Donald Trump, obviously, is a megalomaniac. He's a narcissist. All these things people say, but really what you've got in him, forget the man for a minute, you have the symbol of the derangement that has overtaken the Republican Party. This is no longer a normal political party. This is a deranged group of sociopaths. Seriously, I don't mean every individual Republican voter. I'm talking about the character of the party is sociopathic. It is now built on only one thing. 7.5 years of vilification of our first black president, period. That's what the party's been about. They have threatened to shut down the government. They have threatened to destroy the world economy rather than funding his health care proposals. They have lied about him. They've used people like Donald Trump as a megaphone to spread lies that even they know are not true. The fact of the matter is they now have got exactly what they deserve. And I predict a sweeping victory for the Democrats this fall. I predict that the Republicans will lose the Senate. And 100 years from now, when the history books are written, they're going to forget the details, and they're going to say that this was the final bubbling up of the hate-filled, racist, white, underclass, underbelly of America. This is the last lynching, if you want to put it this way, that they will get away with. If you look at the history of the presidency of Barack Obama, I wrote a piece once that had a lot of downloads called The Slow Motion Lynching of President Barack Obama. I told the truth as I see it in that piece, and that is obviously he has not really been lynched in physical terms, but what they have done to him essentially is gather a mob and drag him to the edge of the town, as it were. They have not hung him, but what they've done is they have obstructed him on a basis, step by step, that has nothing to do with logic. Just take one thing, the health care reform debate that centered around what he was doing as if it was something outlandish, when in fact it was something a Republican governor came up with in my own state here in Massachusetts. And they treated it like it was from outer space. You know, that's not a very dramatic thing, but when you think about it and you add it to everything else, what we've seen with President Obama is the backlash against a black man sitting in the White House who was elected by the majority of Americans twice, as if somehow he's not a legitimate president.
That's right. I mean, we see it, frankly,
he was George Bush, who was elected on a few hanging chads in Florida, whereas he had a significant vote, and they treat him as if he's not the real president.
And Frank, we should say that nothing highlights that more, at least this week, than the idea that the Senate would not even entertain the idea of him nominating a replacement for Antonin Scalia. We have to take a break, but when we come back, Frank, I want to ask you, what is it about evangelicals that are, I don't know if flocking is the right word to Donald Trump, but one would think that evangelicals would be turned off by Donald Trump, at least in terms of our understanding of them, and maybe you can give us a better sense of how we understand them. And then I want to ask you, do you really think this is the end? I mean, even if Donald Trump goes down in flames in a general election, is this the end? We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Frank Schaefer when we return on Ring of Fire. We're back on Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with New York Times bestselling author and former right-wing evangelical leader Frank Schaefer. So, Frank, when we broke, you were talking about Donald Trump as the natural, logical culmination of 8 years of the Republican Party, the conservative movement, essentially basing their entire existence on a backlash to an African American, to a black president, and it filters in everything else. I mean, let me just say
one thing. I just got to add something right there. Not just a black president who 20 years ago would have been a moderate Republican.
I mean,
this guy, talk about somebody who's not of the far left. You know, Jack Kemp and George W. Bush Sr. or Gerald Ford and Barack Obama all would have gotten along fine. They would have had some different policies. on economics, but when it came to health care reform, for instance, this was what Jack Kemp was pushing for, and
yes,
other people before him, even Nixon. So let me just add that as a caveat. The irony here is that the Republicans are stripped of all excuses. Had he been a radical leftist, if he had had policies that could have been described that way, you'd say, okay, well, it could be about policy. 20, 30, 40 years ago, he has not been any more radical than Eisenhower was.
Well, I mean, isn't Donald Trump's ascendancy also evidence that it's never been about policy? Because Donald Trump is to the left of Barack Obama on trade deals. He is
Right. Arguably
to the left of Barack Obama, at least where Barack Obama was on Social Security and Medicare in terms of refusing to cut it.
Right.
He is. I mean, this is indicative of the fact, it seems to me, that the Republican Party, at least a huge swath of them, at least the center of
right.
the party, the ballast
right.
of the party, is really more about what they call anti-PC, which is just simply another way of saying we want to be able to articulate our racism, our misogyny, and, you know, even if we can't put it into practice, we resent the fact that we can't articulate it anymore.
I mean, look, you were talking about the evangelicals before the break. Let me
yes.
just bring up two things which you know about. What happened recently? Gordon College, which is near me in Massachusetts, has a president who's very right-wing now, who's getting rid of professors who gainsay him, and he wrote a letter to President Obama demanding to be exempted from ordinary anti-discrimination laws for any gay people he finds teaching in his college. He wants to be able to fire them without due process, and he said it's a religious freedom. Wheaton College, this evangelical bastion near Chicago, went to the Supreme Court, like the Hobby Lobby case, argued and won so that they wouldn't have to provide contraception coverage for insurance purposes to their female employees. All of this is being done in the name of religious freedom. So look at this. What is religious freedom boiling down to now in these evangelical groups? Right-wing reaction against women, right-wing reaction against gays, right-wing reaction against black people, couched as religious freedom. So religious freedom now becomes the catchphrase for stripping other people of their civil liberties. That is the whole deal in a nutshell. And that's where the evangelical right has gone that I used to be part of, that I've written about in books like my Crazy for God, which is a memoir, or my new book, Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. That's what these books are about. And all I'm doing is tracing a course saying, listen, not only are these people off the rails, even judged by their own standards 30 years ago, they're radical bomb throwers.
What was it? I mean, how does one, and maybe this is an obvious question, but how does one grow this in an era where society at large is moving in the other direction? Or is it because society at large is moving in a certain direction?
You got it. That's it. Listen, this is a xenophobic stand of a white minority within a minority, in the sense that it's not just the overall demographic. There's a lot of white people who voted for Barack Obama and who think he's a good president today. I'm not talking about all white people, but just like the primary caucuses are really come down. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Right.
It comes down to 20 or 30,000 people out of a country of 360 million or whatever we are today. And you look at this, well, this is the same phenomena. This racist white minority within the white minority is the tail wagging the dog. And if we could just get past these voter registration things that have curtailed black voting and discouraged it, if we could just get past the gerrymandering, if we could just get a Supreme Court justice that would roll back the big money incursion into politics, the dark money that the Koch brothers and other people have been lavishing into our system, 100 million at a pop, the actual vote of the American people, when you get to the real American people, is not as racist and xenophobic as these guys by a long shot. We elected Barack Obama, but then this group of people, this Tea Party minority, this group funded by the Koch brothers that's now biting them in the butt by pushing the extremes and making them look bad, they have delegitimized the presidency of Barack Obama because he's black, period. That's it. There are no policy discussions here. It's straight out racism.
And again, you know, we mentioned this in the first half, but I mean, we could see that in the context of Trump. All right. So let me ask you this. Do you think, and because I agree with you, I think it's quite clear now that Trump is going to be the nominee There really is no strong rational
argument. Hey, and just to prove what we're both saying, what was the statement of his that really got everybody fired up in his corner of these people? When he called Mexicans rapists.
Right.
When he said they were all killers and criminals. When
right.
he said he'd build a wall like the Berlin Wall to make America look like a dictatorship. When he talked about bombing things flat. In other words, what was the thing that keyed everything off? What endeared him to the hearts of the Barack Obama haters? It was to be told that he knew how to take care of these brown people and stop them coming in here, period. That's what got them all energized. If he had talked about anything else first, he never would have gotten their attention. The minute he zeroed in on some poor little girl coming across the border with her older sister because her skin is brown and call her a rapist as she's locked up in a child care facility for wanting to come and join her mother or to escape a rape in her own country being trafficked or whatever, you know, if you look at what Donald did as the foundation of this campaign, it's one of the ugliest racist slurs in the memory of American people. You know, there are people in the Jim Crow South who didn't label everybody who was black and brown a rapist. He did. And then he backed off a little bit, but that's what got this thing fired up, was straight out bigotry.
I absolutely agree with you. And I should say, and we should make it clear, that what Donald Trump did was he just listed off a litany. He spoke for an hour and a half, I think, that day. And so it was less that he thought that he was going to be able to run and launch his campaign off the idea that Mexican immigrants or that Latin American children coming in are rapists and criminals. It was that he hung out a lot of things. And that right. was the thing that attracted a huge percentage of Republicans and provided the electoral foundation for what we're seeing today. Frank Schaefer, thank you so much for your time today. We will, link to that piece in the Huffington Post at ringoffireradio.com.
Thanks a lot.
Frank Schaefer is a New York Times bestselling author. His latest book, Crazy for God, can be found where books are sold. You can read his latest piece, an open letter to the Republican leadership from one of your own, on the Huffington Post. When we come back, Pap will be joined by Ring of Fire TV co-host Farron Cousins. Talk about the biggest news stories of the week. And if you missed any part of this show, go to ROFpodcast.com and subscribe to our podcast. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio.
I'm Mike Papantonio, and you've been listening to a free sample of Ring of Fire Radio. If you'd like to listen to the full show, subscribe to our weekly podcast at our website at ringoffireradio.com. It's your support that helps keep us on the air.